Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Time for the Friday gathering now, and this week I'm joined by Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin North West Paul McAuliffe, Green Party leader and TD for Dublin West Roderick O'Gorman, political editor with the journal.ie Christina Finn, and journalist and commentator Brenda Power. Now, let's start with that news that broke at 10 o'clock this morning when Sinn Féin announced that they're not going to go to the White House for St. Patrick's Day. Paul, I might come to you first on this, because Micheál Martin, we know, is holding out to get the invitation and he will go. What will be the impact of Sinn Féin's decision?
Well, I suppose that's for Sinn Féin in some ways.
Well, no, it's going to be on your party's plate now, because this is going to be a big topic when you go over there.
Yeah, I think it will be. And I suppose as a party in opposition, Sinn Féin have the luxury of being able to make that decision that they're not going to engage. Like, it's important for people to understand that the St. Patrick's diplomatic mission is much broader than just the White House event. It involves discussions in regard to trade. It's at federal level, state level. There's governors involved. I'm really perplexed at what the ask of Sinn Féin is. They're sort of saying that we're not going, but we want the Taoiseach to be able to make the following points. And I sort of, there's a degree of hypocrisy in that position. I think Ireland has key interests here. And I think around the world, governments are using the opportunity to engage with the new administration to make the points that are important to them, and to do so at a meeting. Like, the King of Jordan is able to sit down with Donald Trump and talk to him about their relationship. At the same time, we'll have fundamental disagreements about what the proposals are in regard to Gaza. So I don't understand the logic behind Sinn Féin's position. I think there's a real hypocrisy in it in terms of asking us to make particular statements, but they're not willing to attend.
Well, Roderick,
and I think it's a missed opportunity.
Roderick, can I bring you in on this? Because there are plenty of people in this country who will agree with what Matt Carthy had to say on this programme earlier, that there comes a time when you have to take a stand. Did they make the right call?
Well, I wasn't surprised at the call they made. I think it would have been untenable for them to travel in light of the stance they've taken on Gaza. But in particular, I think probably the decision of the SDLP a couple of weeks ago would have put real pressure on them in terms of the contrast that would have created if Sinn Féin were to go and the SDLP weren't to go. Obviously, it is different. Mary Lou isn't attending as she's a leader of an opposition party. The position of the Taoiseach as leader of the country is different. And when he speaks on behalf of the country. So, you know, over the last number of months, anticipating a potential Trump presidency, you know, I was thinking, what is the right way to handle this? And I do believe in engagement. I do believe in being in the room and making the case to people, even with people you fundamentally disagree with, as Paul said. Mm-hmm. But I would make one caveat. Even the last week, the scale of change that the Trump presidency represents, this isn't just now somebody who I and many people profoundly disagree with politically, but has, you know, won an election and we have to accept that. Like, the way in which he's undermining norms domestically and internationally, like the open embrace of a dictator, this is so different to his last presidency that whereas the Taoiseach will travel this year, there will be engagement this year.
Are you saying that there's a question mark over whether he should go?
The Taoiseach will go this year.
Yeah, but
and
do you
think
he
will raise those points. But I think the absolute certainty that Ireland would have always had, that yes, we always engage with the US president, whoever he or she is. I think as this presidency unfolds, there's now a question mark in my mind about that I didn't expect to have.
Because, Paul, you mentioned the King of Jordan, and the same thing happened to the Indian Prime Minister when they went into the Oval Office. They were embarrassed. They were humiliated in front of the world's press in the Oval Office. And there is a great risk, very high risk, given the issue of tariffs and the trade surplus, that the same thing will happen to Micheál Martin.
Yeah, but you have to be in the room to make those points. And Micheál Martin is the Taoiseach of Ireland.
To be humiliated.
There's a very significant trade between Ireland and the United States. There are hundreds of thousands of people whose jobs depend on that. And there's a responsibility of the Taoiseach to go to the United States and to make the case for why we should have a positive trade relationship. I think Roderick points to one thing. There is a difference between an opposition party making a decision and then a office holder making that decision. And it is worrying that it would appear that the First Minister of Northern Ireland now won't be in Washington that week. I'm not clear on all of the details, but it would appear that that's the case.
Oh, it is the case, yeah.
As the United States is a guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement.
Now, we don't know what Emma Little Pengelly is going to do, but that decision has yet to be...
Michelle O'Neill was very keen to take the post of First Minister. She was very keen to say what that would mean, that she'd be the First Minister for everybody. It would appear on this to say, on this occasion, they've made a political decision. And I'm just saying that that has a definite knock-on consequences in terms of the peace process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's aimed at President Trump. It will have an impact cross-party, both Democrats and Republicans.
Okay, Christina, that come up, you were at the press conference at 10 o'clock. Did that come up?
It did, and she was saying there's a distinction to be made between herself and the Taoiseach, and that there are two separate things, and that Emma could make her own call on whether she wants to go. I think it would have been a very different scenario had the institutions not been up and running, had she made the decision not to go. I think things are a lot more in an even keel at the moment in terms of, I suppose, the sort of lobbying and engagement that they would be wanting to have with the American side of things on that space. But I do think, you know, it's interesting to see Mary Lou MacDonald making this decision now. Pressure was put on her last year as well, because the SDLP hadn't gone. So the pressure was there. But I suppose the point is the players have changed now. You know, Biden, there was a lot of question marks over the US role here and what sort of influence we could have on Patrick's Day last year in terms of speaking to Joe Biden, that we had a better relationship. You know, he loved Ireland, that he might actually listen to us. Mary Lou MacDonald wouldn't have that ear of Trump on this trip. I suppose the real impact might be things like the Speaker's Lunch, which is held on Capitol Hill. She'd be sitting down next to some very serious American power players in terms of, for a guts of an hour, the kind of conversation she would have. The Ireland Funds Dinner is held during the week, which is like a massive event where you'd have both Democrats and Republicans there, and there's a lot of schmoozing around between you know, powerful people there. So there are probably opportunities there that are lost for Sinn Féin in terms of that argument that they're making. But I think politically back home, it'll play very well for them. I think the reaction so far that I've seen is that it's welcome to a degree. It's a very different scenario of the Taoiseach not going as the leader of the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an interesting call that they have made. She has said now that it's not something they're going to do. Like, it's not set in stone that this is a 4-year boycott, that it's going to be made
on a
year by year basis,
it comes up,
depending what happens.
OK, Brenda, your take on this. Does it make things very tricky now for Micheál Martin going over there? If he's invited.
And I mean, that's the point you made to Matt Carty just now. Well, hang on a second. We don't know that you were ever going to get an invitation, or that anybody is going to get an invitation. So, I mean, to me, there's a whiff of throwing the head or having the hoo-ha, as you put it, before it becomes moot, because they may not be invited at all. That's one thing. I think it's a hugely irresponsible thing to do. Of course, it makes life very difficult for the Taoiseach. As Paul said, this is not just about the bowl of shamrock, and it's not even just about the incumbent. This is a privilege that a very small peripheral country has had for a number of years, and to put it in jeopardy in any way. And also, another thing, you said to Mike Carty there, what do you expect Donald Trump's reaction to this will be? And he said, who knows? Absolutely. But if you have any small glimpse of what Donald Trump is like over the past 4 years, you know a couple of things about him. First of all, he is a very petty, very vindictive and, very powerful man who will have absolutely no compunction about punishing us for this. We have very few friends in the current regime in Washington. His Commerce Secretary is already on record as saying it's a joke that Ireland, of all places, is running a trade deficit at America's expense. And one more point, Claire. The day after those horrific scenes in Gaza yesterday, and whatever your sympathies, those were horrific scenes where the bodies of two little babies were handed over to cheering and singing and clapping. Gazans there with their own children to cheer these scenes in circumstances where they had been asked, and the Red Cross has confirmed that they asked for dignity and privacy for the handing over of these bodies, one of whom doesn't even appear to be the woman who was clearly separated from her kids when she was murdered. The fact is that whatever way you play this, that this will be seen in Washington, whether intentionally or not, as a pro-Hamas move by a very prominent Irish political party.
But this is a party of opposition. I mean, surely that distinction can be made.
You trusting Donald Trump to make those distinctions? He thinks millions of people were killed in Ukraine. The details pass over that man's head. What will be taken away from this is that Ireland is anti-Israel.
Paul, do you agree that that's going to be the result of this decision?
I think one of the fallouts of us using the English language is that everything that happens in our media, on Twitter and so on, is very easily consumed in the United States. So there's no doubt that this will be a factor. And let's not pretend, Sinn Féin have a very significant presence in Irish America. They're very well known on the political landscape. And so their views will also be well known, and it will have an impact on Ireland's foreign policy. I think it is a reckless move by Sinn Féin.
It's no secret that Sinn Féin have been a pro-Palestinian party for decades. Do you know that it's not like this is a new factor.
With respect, Christine, sometimes when you're in the United States, that's not always as obvious. You know, Sinn Féin do tend to make different arguments in different locations. And so, look, my view is that we've a much broader range of interests here, that we have to make sure that Ireland's interests are represented, but with Republicans with Democrats.
Brenda went to this earlier on. Like, there is no invitation yet, and usually there'd be a lot of tick-tacking, a lot of the arrangements would be in place. There's a certain amount of that happening from what we can glean, but certainly not as much as you would have in other years.
Well, the invites
years.
Tend not to be issued until March.
Yes. Yeah, but does this put the invite at risk? Are you concerned about that now?
Well, we can't say that. And look, the diplomatic mission is much broader than just the White House event, as I say. And, you know, like, there will be other events by agencies, by trade agencies. Like, for example, the Northern Ireland Trade Board have a very significant event each year where they're trying to promote trade into Northern Ireland, as do the Irish government. So it's a much broader mission than just the one event. And we have ministers travelling to Irish communities right across the United States. And that is this is a unique opportunity for us to make case to policymakers right across the world.
Yeah, we have
people don't often have it from other countries.
So we have eight ministers going, Roderick. We have the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach go just to the United States. I mean, as somebody who's been on those trips, are they worth it?
I was a sceptic, I suppose, before I saw the opportunities that they opened up. And I think certainly I was on trips to the United States and Japan, where I saw, I suppose, our ability to have diplomatic and political influence, the ability to open up doors to universities, to enterprises, to employers that wouldn't have been opened previously.
So you're talking they're not just conversations, you're saying. You could see that there were results coming from those
absolutely,
visits.
Absolutely.
But then you've raised a question mark now over the visit.
Well, there's a difference between, I suppose, a visit and a direct engagement with President Trump. And, you know, Brenda raised the point that this is a really valuable meeting. But I just think we have to look at how this develops, because with this particular incumbent, there is a real risk that these meetings may, in March, if it happens, and going forward, may be actually used as an opportunity to humiliate us as a country. So again, I see the value of this, and I think we should never downplay the level of access we have, particularly in the United States. But I do think all bets are off in terms of how this presidency is unfolding. Mm. It is so different from the last time. It is so different from everything we've unseen. And this isn't just, again, I make this clear, this isn't just because I strongly disagree with everything Donald Trump stands for. It's that Donald Trump is not playing by the constitutional rules of his own country, or indeed engaging with international norms.
Yeah, I've travelled to the for the Oval Office visit a number of times over the last few years, and I was there for the last Trump presidency, and there is definitely a stark difference between the likes of Joe Biden and Trump when you're sitting there. It's traditional that you're not actually meant to ask questions within the Oval Office, and Joe Biden and his staff were quite strict on that, and he wouldn't respond. On the other hand, when we were there for Donald Trump, he took questions for 22 minutes or so, and he was liable really to say anything. So that is, I think, the risk there for Micheál Martin, that you're sitting down next to Donald Trump with a ball of shamrock between you. You have the American press and the Irish press there, you know, throwing questions from, are you coming to visit Ireland? When are you coming back to Doonbeg? What do you think of the Occupied Territories Bill? And he's liable to say anything, and Micheál Martin kind of has to walk a very fine line and be ready for that.
And Brenda, you wanted to wear that?
No, I was just going to say, and as Roderick was saying there, that coming back to that same point, this is not the time to rock the boat. This is absolutely not the time to throw a curveball into play. This man is extremely unpredictable and much more unpredictable than he previously was. Now, he could go either way, actually. I mean, you know that when he went to meet Governor Gavin Newsom in Los Angeles, having called him new scum and called it for his resignation, when he got to meet him face to face, he was all, oh, you're a great guy, you're doing a fantastic job. He's completely able to go either way. So he could be all over Micheál Martin like a rash, or he could indeed use the opportunity to humiliate us. But the fact that this particular curveball has been thrown into play means it is more likely that he will want to be vindictive and to settle a score.
Let's move on. I want to talk about housing, that other big news story from during the week, where we had Minister of State John Cummins putting on the table that planning restrictions or the need for planning around log cabin type structures might be removed as a potential solution, one of the solutions to the housing crisis. Roger O'Gorman, there's a lot of people who are really welcoming this. I mean, you were in government during 4 years of the housing crisis. Is there a reason why it wasn't suggested earlier, particularly at a time when we were looking to house all of the Ukrainians who were coming in here?
Well, I think we have to look at it in the context of our planning system and a system that's there to protect the public good. Now, we're seeing huge pressure on accommodation right now. I think we have to look at all options.
Was it not looked at, though, during your time?
It wasn't brought forward as a serious proposal.
Because all of the politicians who've spoken about it now this week are saying, oh, we're getting it from the constituents all of the time that they want these things in their gardens. So,
well, I think
I just don't know why it didn't come up before now.
How this is done is really important. If this just becomes a blanket exemption that anybody can throw up one of these log cabins in the back garden, it has a risk that, A, they could start being actually put out to rent, which I think whatever the government does, they have to be absolutely clear that these are for the house owners' own use. It can't be as a new kind of income stream. But secondly, it shouldn't be done as an exemption. If it is to be done, maybe look at a 10-year license for one of these cabins, so the local authority has some oversight over what's happening here, because these will have to be connected to sewers or foul water. They'll have to be connected to drainage system.
In both those cases, Roderick, the inspection regime that you would need would be huge. Like, you'd have to have people going out to check that it wasn't being rented, to check that they were adhering to the 10-year rule.
And that has to be understood in any proposal to bring this forward, because the alternative is that you will have these going up at scale in small gardens all over our country. I've already dealt with issues where a log cabin has been, I suppose, controversial among neighbours. And if we do this in an absolutely unregulated way, myself, Paul, all the rest of us in Leinster House, we're going to be dealing with literally hundreds of cases of people where there's a controversy. Maybe it's gone into the wrong sewage pipe. There's overshadowing and the like. So I think if a change is to be made here, it has to be done through a licensing process and not a broad planning exemption, because I think that would be a recipe for disaster.
Paul, it sounds like it could be very messy. Do you agree that they shouldn't be used for letting outside of the family?
Well, so there's a danger here that people think that we think this is some sort of silver bullet to solve the housing crisis. It's not. The fundamental way of addressing the housing issue is by building more homes, and that is what we have been doing and it's what we want to do. In some ways, I think this is an attempt to regulate what's happening at the moment. So I've dealt with many cases where people have port cabins at the back garden, a neighbour has made a complaint against them, and the planning division have actually evicted the person from the cabin, and then they have to go in and seek emergency accommodation. So I think there will be places where this makes sense, and there will be places where it doesn't. I think a blanket eviction, blanket exemption could be very problematic. And I think there's two real fears that people will have. One is fire. And having a separate access may be the criteria that we need to impose there. If you're trapped between two burning buildings and a back garden, that's not a good planning policy.
So you wouldn't be able to have it in a terraced house then?
Yeah, I think that could be one of the examples where it might not work. And the other question will be, there's minimum distances between homes for a very valid reason. It's around privacy and antisocial behaviour and so on. And again, we will have to look at that and how families living in a back garden in a very close proximity to another home, and the way some semi-detached homes are built, taking away privacy and so on. But I think
sounding more and more impractical by the minute.
And that is why we're having a consultation process. It's and I think it's very clear this is should not be seen as some sort of new quick fix idea. This is about regularising something that will work in some places and that where it shouldn't be applied in others. It's why we're having a consultation and that will be brought back, and the Minister, James Brown, who has ultimate responsibility for this, will have to bring a memo forward to Cabinet.
Christina, lots of people do think this is a good idea, right?
Yeah, very much so. I think it's been interesting to see sort of the mixed feelings that people have about it, because I think when people first hear about it, they just are like, God, this housing crisis has just got so much worse that now we're talking about log cabins out the back. But I feel like this is sort of an attempt to try and address the symptom, like one of the symptoms of the housing crisis, because like these things are happening already. And I think people will know there's been cases of enforcement where people live in those cabins out the back where they have to be dismantled, the family's evicted. As you said, they might end up on the housing list. I think the problem here is there going to be people seeing this as an opportunity, being a bit greedy, putting something up and, you know, renting it out for an extortionate amount of money? I think enforcement is key, and I've been told that the idea is that it won't be for renting, but how you're going to enforce that, as you said, is going to be a massive issue. But I kind of feel now when people are hearing these ideas and I'm speaking to people about it in work, just about, it feels like a sort of we'll take what we can get now at this point, you know. And I wonder whether some of the ideas of the past, you know, we had co-living, talk about building smaller houses, smaller apartments, they're absolutely, you know, trashed a couple of years ago. And now it kind of feels like we're almost...
We'll take anything.
Like we're almost like, geez, like just, and you know, this is a terrible, this isn't a solution, this isn't anything. But people are so desperate out there, I think, at the moment. But my point is, I think that the Housing for All revised plan, which I understand is meant to be published before summer, there has to be some big ideas in that. Like, this is make or break, I think, for this government. It should have been probably for the last one. Mm-hmm. It definitely is for this one.
So this, for you, isn't the big idea or
no,
a big idea?
No, and I don't
idea.
Think people should take it as the big idea, but I think a lot of people are taking it as... like they're hearing it and going, oh God, like I'm so desperate right now, should I consider this?
Mm-hmm.
I think
that's, but it will work though, Brenda, for some people, right?
Yeah, it will work for some people. I mean, obviously regulation is going to be key, but I think my impression is that the people to whom it will be of most benefit are maybe people living in one-off housing around the country who do have a substantial mm-hmm. piece of ground, and maybe children who are working in the nearest town or whatever. I don't think anybody's suggesting that this is the solution to the housing problem. It is one element of a number of solutions. But I mean, the point is, if it, we saw recently that there were, I think, 100 people sleeping in their cars queuing to buy affordable properties in a development in Leixlip. There were 31 properties for sale. I mean, if even 10 less turn up next time because they have been able to locate a property in their parents' garden or whatever, that's a small step towards resolving the issue. It's not the answer for everybody. Mm-hmm. It may just help some family through a difficult patch. And I mean, it's not unrealistic in rural areas, because, you know, you're talking about pressure on water and sewage. Most of these developments have their own septic tanks, for example, so they would be able to utilise that. It is just another element, and the haste with which these things are always shut down is just bearing, because I mean, I remember when Owen Murphy suggested co-living, and it was immediately shot down. Oh, these will be 21st century bedsits. And he said, well, we all lived in bedsits. Well, you know what, we did. Mm-hmm. And what happened when you shut down this option?
When he said, you know, it would be like living in a boutique hotel, that's when people had an issue with it.
Okay, but what happened was, when this didn't materialise, on the basis that, well, you can't expect people to share laundry facilities and you can't ask them to share kitchens, what happened? They rented houses which might otherwise be sold to families, and, you know, shared laundry facilities and shared kitchens, in many cases with people they don't know, because they're paying 200 or 300 euros a week for a box room.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I want to, in the last bit of time we have left, find out what's going on with the Dáil speaking row. Christina, your best place to take us through this, because there have been developments. So what's happening?
Yeah, so obviously the Dáil speaking row kind of blew up, obviously, on the first day of the Dáil, and it was sort of a temporary solution was kind of brought forward, that Verona Murphy would, you know, take a look at this, and that they'd kind of come back with some sort of idea. And now we see that the opposition have come out, and last night a joint statement, which is actually interesting to see everybody again singing off the same hymn sheet, that they just don't want the ministers that are regional independents, who are not they're TDs, but they're not ministers, having separate sort of time.
This would be like a new group for these government supporting TDs,
kind of an in betweeny group between government and opposition.
Brenda, you're smiling at me.
Yeah, no, and I just reading the description here, they said it argues that in a modern parliament, it's not necessarily made up of government and opposition TDs, and some TDs cannot be readily placed in either of these categories. So we're talking about kind of a non-binary group.
We're talking about a non-binary group of
TDs.
But that's not going to wash, Roderick.
No, it's
with
not.
You.
I described the original proposal 3 weeks ago to give opposition time to this group as a stroke, and what we're seeing now is a con job, this idea of other members being created. And that line that that Brenda read out there, like, that is not reality. There aren't these kind of amorphous groups within our parliaments. And, you know, the government is trying to basically rewrite reality to please Mike Lowry and his group. And it won't be
accepted. The real world impact of this row rumbling on is that it's causing delays for committees being put together, right? And that's where a lot of the real work happens.
And the reason that it is going on is that the government is giving the almost identical proposal that they gave 3 weeks ago, and now they're calling them other members, and they're inventing this.
Have you read the proposal?
I have read the proposal. I have read the proposal.
In any conscience say that's what we're trying to do.
It is the exact same, and the fact, and I don't want to get nerdy into the standing orders and that, but the fact that they're actually citing the existing standing orders shows that is exactly is what they're doing. They're just trying to create this new category of other members.
People out there must be wondering, why can we not get an agreement?
Well, why can't
you
seem to be at a loss as to how to solve this, because Louise Byrne was on Morning Ireland, she said there's going to be all war breaking out again now at the business committee over
agreement
this.
Agreement requires a bit of compromise, Paul, and there's been no compromise.
It does, Roderick, absolutely. So let's establish what's happened. The Cam Corda has clearly ruled that the regional independent groups are not groups in opposition. She's ruled that. That's settled. There's no attempt to blur the lines between opposition and government. But what is clear is that there's many people in the House, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and now the regional independent groups, who do not have the appropriate or even adequate speaking time. I'll just give you two examples, Claire. There were two private members' businesses this week. The opposition had 100 minutes, government ministers had 20 minutes, government backbench TDs had 0 minutes. In the next 6 weeks, we'll have priority questions. Sinn Féin will have 47 priority questions. The Social Democrats, for example, will have 11. Government backbench TDs will have 0.
So your point is,
if you're a government TD,
you're in an unfair position, is your point.
A deeply unfair position.
It doesn't even address government TDs. It addresses this new group.
You're misreading it. It addresses all groups who do not qualify under Standing Order 170, which at the moment in this style would be Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Regional Independents. All three of them will be able to avail of a new slot. And it's really... it's galling for opposition TDs who get the majority of speaking time in the Dáil.
People like Roderick.
You don't have to be an expert in standing orders, Claire. Just turn on the Dáil any day. It's the same small few people speaking all the time. And that's not an accident. It's because of the structures. And all we're doing here is giving opportunities for people who have an equal mandate to stand up and ask questions about their constituency and the issues that are important to them. And it's deeply undemocratic for the opposition to suggest otherwise.
It does sound reasonable that government backbench TDs should have an opportunity to speak, Roderick.
And they do. It is absolutely reasonable, and they absolutely do. They have an opportunity. They can speak on,
Roderick,
on statements.
Roderick,
on
you're 2 months out of government.
On priority legislation.
Listen, speaking of minutes and speaking time, our time is up. Thank you all so much. Thank you at home for listening. Niamh Lyons is a series producer and was today's producer as well. Research by Emma Cawley. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Kieran Dunn was on sound. Thank you to all of the team this week. Let's go over to Louise.